live on the phone, and that's meteorologist Rick DeMaio. Rick, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Mike. You need to call us a mini-me, right? The Mike Novak Internet Experience. That's short for mini.
Mini-me.
Okay. Yeah, I like it.
You know what? I'll run it past the committee. How's that?
Run it past the new Republican Congress and see what they say.
Okay, you're going to go down that road just to start, aren't you? you had to go there, didn't you?
Yeah, why not? Hey, I just spent the week down in Phoenix, Arizona at the American Meteorological Society Conference, and getting to see Catherine Sullivan, who is the director or the administrator of NOAA, and she is also what they call the Under Secretary of Commerce, talk about, you know, where things are going to be in 25 years and where we were 25 years ago, was pretty enlightening. You know, it's always nice to have a Washingtonian experience there. And then a couple of days later, hearing Gina McCarthy, head of the EPA, talk about climate change and the public reaction to it and where we need to take the science from an educational standpoint. I had to bring the Washingtonian, you know, little jab in there, but I think from a standpoint of eye-opening experience, the 4 or 5 days, the weather in the upper 70s and 80 degrees always makes it a little bit more enjoyable, but it's always nice to kind of break out of your locale and bring in the more international and national experience into what you do from a scientific standpoint. I think it makes you a more well-rounded educator.
I imagine it does, and the stuff you sent me was pretty interesting. You can address what each of them said, but to start, Gina McCarthy said some really interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
About, it's not just about climate change, it's about how science is under attack. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I think Gina raises a lot of points that, you know, I've been talking about for the last 4 or 5 years on your show every Sunday, which is I think we began to approach climate change, climate variability, global warming, you know, from the top of the roof down. And we looked down at anybody who wasn't doing things the way we thought they should be done. Case in point, I think it all began with, you know, Al Gore's attempt to basically bludgeon people into believing that the world is going to be a burning cinder in 50 years. And while I applaud Al Gore's efforts, and mainly because he took a chance on bringing a somewhat obscure part of the science to the forefront, and he did it in a couple of different ways, well, actually three different ways, in his PowerPoint presentations, through the movie, which was kind of a documentary, historical, scientific, I guess the best way to describe it was, adventure. Then obviously through his book as well, it was a little bit heavy-handed. And I think it kind of needed to be that way to get, you know, kind of shake the cage, so to say. But what made things worse was I think everybody kind of got on the bandwagon, and you started to see, you know, Discovery Channel movies about global warnings and how the polar bears are going to all be, you know, falling into the Arctic Ocean, which was now becoming, you know, less covered with ice. And, you know, people were no longer going to be able to eat and drink the way they normally do in remote parts of the world. So I think the train kind of got off the tracks a little bit.
Well, let me ask you a quick question about that.
Yeah.
A lot of that stuff was true. He was speaking the truth, wasn't he?
He was, but I remember, and I think, Mike, it was evident when you and I saw him back, I believe that was, 2009.
Yeah.
He gave his talk at Chicago Theater, and what irked me was that he basically finished up and said thank you very much and walked off the stage. He didn't take any questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that moment of going, huh? That's not why I came here. I wanted to come here and talk to him about this stuff. And I think the same thing happened in the 2000 elections. he never really brought it up much when he was campaigning. It was almost like, well, you know what, I realize this is now an issue that's not as popular across the board as I thought it was. And this was before An Inconvenient Truth came out. So I'm going to play the middle of the road and not talk about it. So I think what happened was a lot of the things that he needed to talk about, he did talk about, but because it was Al Gore, he didn't really get a chance to, I think, bring it into the whole forum from a centrist standpoint. And I think that kind of hurt. And this goes back to what Gina McCarthy was saying, was that we needed to find a different way of talking about it so we can bring more people on board to discuss the hows and whys of how to make everybody understand how this is going to be a problem, not just now, but for the next 50 years as well, and something that everybody could be a part of, and not just one side. And I think she did a really good job of that.
Okay, so she brought up the idea, as I mentioned earlier, too, that one of the things that has happened because of this approach, which you say might have been done better, is an all-out attack on science. And I kind of see that, too, because it's slopped over from climate change to pretty much everything having to do with science. People who don't happen to appreciate or like a certain scientific view now just say, well, the science isn't settled on it, knowing that science is almost never 100%, that you get a theory and the best theory wins, basically. And so that allows some people to attack almost anything that's out there. And as a result, our textbooks are being changed, are being modified in ways that are not really good for us. So what about this appeal to science by Gina McCarthy?
Well, you mentioned something about textbooks. I remember when I started teaching a climate change class about 7 or 8 years ago, the book that I was using was Michael Mann from Penn State, and it was called Global Warming Dire Predictions. And there was basically every chapter is about how things are changing and how things are going to be really bad in the next 50 years. The book I'm using now is called Global Climate Change. Notice it's not called Global Warming. And the title, the subtitle is Turning Knowledge into Action. So I think what we've seen here is an attempt to broaden the horizon, talk more about the changes, the variabilities, the regional aspects of it, and then how to take something and make something positive out of it, whereas before, I don't think that was really done. And even though there's a lot of people who believe that, you know, the climate has become altered somewhat by humans, there's still a huge percentage of people out there who took advantage of the 2008 economic recession and said, why are we spending money on something that we don't need to be spending money on when we have to worry about people's houses who are foreclosing, unemployment rate of 9.5%, and my 401k is now a 201k. So they had a lot of ammunition that was pretty much based on current facts of an economic downfall that is always going to happen. But they used that to an extent to hammer away at the science and also the policy that was attached to the science. So the science, I think, was more so damaged by the policies that were being driven forward without really going, you know what, we don't need to do all of this. If the policies wouldn't have been implemented or at least tried to become implemented, the science probably would have been left by itself. But because it's difficult to tell someone that, you know, global warming is occurring when you're getting 30 inches of snow in the month of January in Washington, D.C., people are going to go, yeah, you know what, you're right. Why do I need to do this when this is happening in front of me? So I think what's occurred here is this kind of cyclical effect from a standpoint of applying policy to science. And when you strip down the policy and you go, okay, now does this make sense or do we need to do it? We don't. Therefore, the science is now untouched. Now when you have a little bit more sound policy, you go, you know what, you're right, because this policy makes sense based on what we see in front of us. And I think that's the trend that I think we're going to be going into over the next 5 to 10 years. And I think it's a good trend as well. The better thing about it is the improving economy, no matter how much the other side wants to say it's not, will allow us to make some of these changes and also allow us to move a little bit more delicately through this river of information that's becoming more and more apparent from a standpoint of how it affects things more regionally rather than globally.
We're talking to meteorologist Rick DeMaio, who's been a regular on the Mike Novak Show for 6 years, more than 6 years. And in that time, you've always been really... you've stuck to your guns on the whole idea of global warming, which is to say, you never liked that phrase, and rightly so, because it became a straw man that could get knocked down very easily by, well, you know, by a cold snap in the Midwest. Where's your global warming now? But unfortunately, I'm looking at a story that came out of the Japan Meteorological Agency. They're saying that 2014 was the hottest year on record, and I'm sure you're hearing things, and there are going to be other agencies that say the same thing, won't they?
Oh yeah, now without a doubt 2014 will go down as the warmest year on record, but what we also see is over the last 8 to 10 years there's been a noticeable decrease in the amount of warming. And I was talking about this 2 or 3 years ago, that the Earth's temperature has not been warming at the rate that it was between 1988 and about 2000. In fact, I attended, I think, 4 or 5 different talks, and the title of the talks were Global Warming Hiatus, The Truth Behind It. But what was interesting, Mike...
And you're talking when you're talking about those talks you went through, you mean this past week at the meteorological conference.
Right, at the AMS. And these are all scientists and researchers that have been looking at this information now for over 3 or 4 years. And I've been talking about it. And one of the things I did on one of my exams at Loyola University in the new Institute of Environmental Sustainability, I put the chart of global temperatures from 1880 to 2013. And I showed, but there was a distinct line on there that actually showed between 2002 and about 2012, the Earth's temperature has pretty much, you know, leveled off. Now, I have 40 kids in the class, and the question that I had on there was, based on this graph, if someone comes up to you on the street and says that global warming no longer exists, how would you use this graph to help support or defend your information that you've had in this class so far and what this graph shows you? Out of the 40 students, 38 of them said, no, global warming is still going on and carbon dioxide is making the Earth warm up and we have to save this, we have to do this and do that. I only had 2 students who actually said, yeah, you're right, the trend has leveled off a little bit. However, the Earth's temperature is still above normal, but it just hasn't been increasing at the rate it was for the previous 15 years. What those answers showed me, Mike, is that the students still, even after I talked about it in class, were not looking at the data objectively. They were coming into the class with a subjective interpretation that the Earth is warming, and it doesn't matter whether it's anthropogenic, meaning human-induced, or whether or not it's a natural variability, the Earth is warming and we have to do something about it. If you continue to have that type of an attitude, and maybe part of that lies with me, maybe I needed to get the information to them in a little bit stronger sense, but even though I talked about it in class and I gave them that information, it didn't matter. They still said, no, it's warming and we have to change it. By having that attitude, you will be beaten up by the other side. So what you need to do is you need to look at the data a little bit more closely. And what I saw in some of these talks was that even though we've been on a hiatus of global warming, we still continue to see these extreme variations, a high degree of variability, meaning that parts of the Earth are really warm, parts of the Earth have actually gotten really cool, i.e. our winter from last year. parts of the earth have had extreme drought, parts of the earth have had extreme precipitation. So what we then need to do is we need to change the narrative and think more about not so much global warming, but has the earth's temperature increased to a point where, just like a human being, no longer has 101 fever, but it's now at 100. Well, my fever may not be going up, but it's still about a degree and a half above normal. How does that influence, then, their ability and change to such a degree where some of the regional anomalies are becoming unsustainable? And how do we then mitigate those changes? And I think that's where we need to go, and that's why I think some of these discussions from last week's meeting were extremely important. You need to get away from the overall global warming aspect. You need to, I think, identify some of the regional anomalies and then see whether or not the climate has been changing naturally or from a standpoint of anthropogenic changes, and then make the adjustments necessary.
All right. So let me see if I can explain this then. So if the climate of the planet has been such so that there was a warming period and then it kind of stabilized, but we're still above where we should be, does that explain 2014? Because if you're already at a high point in history in terms of global temperature, it only takes a little bump to nudge it up to be the hottest year on record.
Bingo. Absolutely.
Oh,
I think you explained it well.
Woo-hoo.
And then from a standpoint
wait.
Is this the beginning of a new trend? Because what we clearly saw was with the implementation of the Montreal Protocol back in the early 1990s, we did a very good job of reducing the amount of chlorofluorocarbons that we have in the atmosphere. Thus said, we've then been able to help the ozone in both the North Pole and the South Pole return to near normal levels. Ozone, as you know, inhibits some of the infrared or the harmful ultraviolet radiation that we get from the sun. If that radiation is now being trapped in the stratosphere where the ozone is, that means that the stratosphere can go back to its normal temperature, but it also blocks out some of that infrared radiation from, not the infrared, the ultraviolet radiation from the sun into the lower atmosphere, which is called the troposphere. That's the part where we live. Therefore, the troposphere may actually go through a little bit of cooling. And that little bit of cooling, due to the fact that the ozone has now gone back to where it was before, has actually kept the temperature of the earth from warming. So in a sense, by reducing the amount of chlorofluorocarbons in the atmosphere, we've done a good job, which is what we wanted to do, was to keep the Earth's temperature from overheating. You can actually go back and look at the global warming hiatus also relate to the fact that over the last 10 years in the Midwest, we've seen an uptick in the amount of snow. How many winters have we had in the last 10 years of over 50 inches of snow? You've had six. Typically, you don't get that if the Earth is warming. So one of the things that we do see is that the things that we put into effect to help the atmosphere go back to normal have actually helped. Are they enough? Well, we don't know yet. Hindsight is 2020. We may not see that until about 10 years from now. But at least we did something, and clearly that something has worked.
I have to give myself a ding for having gotten that other question right. But as you say, we just don't have the answers to yet.
Right.
Do you feel as though, in general, we're on the right track? There are a lot of folks who think that governments are still moving way too slowly. I happen to be one of those people. Where do you stand on that?
No. We're still not on the right track, because the biggest problem is, or I should say the biggest equation, and this was one of the things that Dr. Sullivan, the head of NOAA, kind of finished up in her keynote address. She says, with all the things that I talked about, the nexus that becomes the most, the three things that creates that nexus is population, energy, and also food and water. How do you provide enough energy and enough food and water? How do you redistribute resources to satisfy the growing population that's expected to reach 8.5 billion by the time we get to 2050? And clearly, there's a huge part of the population, particularly in your developing countries, notice I don't use the word third world, but the developing countries, where you need to have some sort of understanding of how humans have altered the landscape, where you don't have to constantly worry about shipping food to people. It's not like we don't have enough food. The food is just not in the right places. It's not that we don't have enough water. The clean water is not in the right places. So it's all about not so much distribution of wealth, but distribution of resources that, for us, if we're hungry, we walk down the street to the store, we buy something. For us, if it's warm out, we turn the air conditioner on. For us, if it's cold out, we close the window, we put a blanket on. For a large portion of the population of the world, those choices may be there, but they're not as simple as or not as accessible as what we have. And that's really the key.
Well, and the other thing I would add is that we don't respect the resources we have. That is to say, the Great Lakes, for one thing, when you find out that there was an oil leak that was going on for, what, was it two weeks, 2 months over at the nuclear plant in Michigan? We don't know how much oil was spilled. That is,
right.
You know, the Lake Michigan represents as part of the Great Lakes 20% of the fresh water on the planet, and yet we have pipelines running underneath. And in terms of respect for fresh water, the fracking we do across the country, there's great evidence that it's contaminating our aquifers, and yet we're moving forward on that too, as if don't worry, we can fix that later. But you can't. Once the water's fouled, there's nothing you can do. And your dog agrees with me.
Yeah, my dog, he gave that was his example of a ding. But yeah, and I think when you look at the Keystone XL pipeline, as much as there's a chance that it's probably going to get eventually built, we still don't know all the economic, or I should say all the environmental concerns of where that pipeline is actually running, particularly through areas where you have aquifers that may or may not exist from what we know. And I think that's one of the key things from that standpoint is truly getting all your eggs in a basket and understanding all your ducks in a row and truly understanding what are the potential consequences and pitfalls. So the current downtrend in oil prices has actually said, you know what, we could probably go a year or two without building this because we probably don't need it. And notice how many people are not saying, thank you, President Obama, for the low oil prices. They'll be quick to condemn him on higher gasoline prices, but you certainly don't hear a friend of the side about lower gas prices.
Well, he'll be blamed if they go up, but if they go down, you're right, there's going to be deafening silence. But
right, and I think that's probably true for any president.
I think so. And you know, when I see the oil prices go up and they go down, I say, well, the president really has very little to do with that. But the president, whoever he or she is going to take the blame when they go up. Okay, looking at, by the way, this is meteorologist Rick DeMaio, and he's fresh off the big conference, hobnobbing with his fellow meteorologists in the deserts of the Southwest, where the temperatures got to where? How hot did it get when you were down there?
Well, you know, it was amazing because the week before I was down there, readings were only in the 40s, and they had a little bit of snow, believe it or not. That's all everybody was talking about, the fact that it snowed in Phoenix. Not the first time, but still, normal high temperature for them is about 65. When I got down there, it was 70, and then the next two or three days, we had temperatures that eclipsed the 80-degree mark, and one of those days actually broke a record. So it was kind of nice to be in an environment where it was 81 degrees, particularly when back in Chicago it was like 5 above with a wind chill of minus 25.
Don't rub it in.
It certainly made it extremely difficult to come back. But you know me, I embrace winter weather because as long as there's snow on the ground, it looks pretty. I love to go out and cross-country ski, so I'll take the 80-degree weather, but as long as I can come back and enjoy the beauty of nature when there's snow on the ground.
Yeah, and here's
I have no problem with the cold winter.
Here's your opportunity. We just, as we're recording this, got a little more snow last night. Grab the skis. Go on out. Have some fun. So let's get to that in general before I let you go here. Back several months ago, you had predicted, and I'm not throwing this in your face, I'm just telling
you. That's fine.
It was going to be wet, wild, and white. It didn't quite plan. That didn't quite happen here, okay?
No. The month of December, we actually ended up with less than a trace of snow, and I think myself and just about everybody in the weather community was kind of shocked by that. Now, we've kind of caught up pretty quickly here in the first 11 days of the month of January. We've gotten almost a foot of snow.
And let's tell folks, because this is being heard in many places, although I would think primarily Chicagoans are listening. You're talking about the Chicago area. What about the Midwest in general?
The Midwest in general, through the first 10 to 12 days of the month of January, has had above normal snowfall. But even if you go back and you look at the month of November, there was above normal snowfall everywhere in the Midwest. Even though Chicago proper got about 3 inches, there were areas across Missouri, central, southern Illinois, Indiana that got well over 10 to 12 inches of snow. So there are many locations in the Midwest that are above normal snowfall. Through the 10th of January, and believe it or not, we're actually a half inch above normal. Typically by the 11th of January, we have about 13 inches seasonal, and we're up to 13.5. Does it pale in comparison to the 35 inches we had by this time last year? Absolutely. Is the pattern similar this year to what it was last year? Absolutely not. So even though we were trending towards that in the month of November, by the time we got to December, there was basically a full latitude shift of the storm track from the middle part of the country to the west coast, and that 20 degrees in latitudinal shift produced abundant amount of rainfall in California, abundant amount of snowfall in the Rocky Mountains, and it basically put us into a dry, warm regime. So we ended up with the third coldest November, and then they ended up with the fourth warmest December. And that's a huge degree of variability. The month of January, while the first 10, 11 days are actually about 11 to 12 degrees below normal and about 10 inches of snow, I wouldn't be surprised if we finish up the month anywhere between 5 and 6 degrees below normal and with about 20 inches of snow. And then we still have the month of February and March to go through. So I'm still thinking, Mike, that the month of January is going to end up to be a snowy one. The month of February, without a doubt, is going to be a snowy one. And the 60, or I should say the 50 to 70 inches that I predicted early in the year, is probably going to be more like about a 40 or 50. It's going to be tough to really get above 50 inches when you went through the month of December with absolutely no snow. But all you need is one good 15 to 20 inch event, and you can easily be up close to 30 to 35 inches by the time we get to the middle of February.
And you're rooting for it, right?
Of course I am.
Yeah, that's right, because when you make a prediction, you have a really hard job. I wouldn't want to be a meteorologist because, I don't want to get have my reputation based on predicting the future of anything, all right? You do it in a scientific way. The question I have to ask you is, and I know other people have said this, why are we not hearing anything about polar vortexes this year?
Well, because I think we all realize that the term polar vortex is a term that, as meteorologists, we've always used. You know, for some reason, it got to this point where it went viral last year, and I think that's more so due to social media. More than anything, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, the Weather Channel, have just gone nuts with taking anything that sounds kind of sexy and has a little bit of a grab to it, and next thing you know, everybody is talking about it. So the term polar vortex was always something that was in the meteorological vernacular. The fact that it's all of a sudden become the term du jour that people just love to throw around was really quite amazing to me. The fact that people were using that term so often, I thought was just kind of funny. But it's something that we've used all the time, and the fact of the matter is, I think we've learned in this current age of information just sprawls across our phones and our computers faster than we've ever seen before. you got to be kind of careful on what you say and how you say it.
Well, I think
I don't think that changes the fact that we're going to not use that term again. But I think after a while, people just get tired of it and don't just talk about it anymore.
Yeah, I think you and I need to invent another term. That the newest, greatest, sexiest term that we can come up with. I don't know what it is at the moment, but you'll come up with something, won't you?
Without a doubt, yeah.
All right, Rick DeMille, always a pleasure talking to you, and thanks for joining me on the Mike Novak Internet Experience and the Green Divas Radio Network, and you'll be back, I'm sure.
Yep, we'll talk again on the now called the Mini-Me Network.
Right? Oh, I forgot, right, the... The Mini-Me Network.
The Mike Novak Internet Experience, otherwise known as Mini.
Mini. Okay, Rick, I'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Have a good day.